The IER podcast is produced by Creative Kin and sponsored by Thompson Solicitors. Thanks for listening.
This is not ending fire and rehire. This is facilitating fire and rehire. And I think the bill needs to be significantly strengthened if these limitations are to be avoided.
We've had 30, 40 years now of inadequate protection for working people. This is just a modest step in the other direction. And yes, it may appear radical in the sort of narrow context of what's happened before, but it isn't particularly radical. And I think we need to look at it in a wider sphere.
Welcome to the fifth episode of the Institute of Employment Rights podcast. Thanks to Thompson Solicitors for sponsoring the podcast. Please visit www.thompsonswithap.law/employment-bill to find out more from their team of employment law experts on the government's employment rights bill. In this fifth episode, labour law expert Professor Keith Ewing of King's College London, also president of the IER, and Neil Todd, who is a lawyer and partner at Thompson Solicitors, will discuss their analysis of the Labour Party's employment rights bill, this time taking a look at the impact the bill will have on workers on zero-hour contracts and workers who are either coerced into fire and rehire or simply unilaterally fired and replaced in the case of the recent P&O scandal. So first, I thought we'd touch on zero-hour contracts and what the bill does around them. So as a bit of a backstory, regulating zero-hour contracts is something the IER experts have written extensively about. And as we know, zero-hour contracts were brought in initially for people like NHS bank staff who were a small minority of workers, sometimes students or retired workers who were happy to do a bit of work now and then with no commitments. These contracts were then rolled out across sectors by unscrupulous employers as a means of replacing permanent contracts that had better terms and conditions. So this effectively withheld, as we know, the rights and pay from workers, as well as artificially boosting profits for employers at the direct expense of workers. And I have friends and family with young children who are on zero-hour contracts just to make ends meet. And they have serious problems planning their monthly living expenses. It makes it near impossible to buy a house as the bank can't see or foresee regular income. And there are serious problems with job security, you know, with things like heating, feeding and clothing costs when they come down to bite, especially if workers have young children. So this baked-in precarity really has been a step backwards for workers, and it's a bleak prospect for current and future generations too. And I think, as you said before, Keith, workers are incorrectly being viewed as commodities by rogue employers. So firstly, what do you both think of the provisions in the bill around zero-hour contracts? For instance, does the bill give any job security to workers on zero-hour contracts or stop them being exploited at work? Keith, do you want to go first?
Yeah, well, thanks very much, James. I think just to endorse what you said, I mean, this is an example of casualisation of workers, but it's only one example of casualised contractual relationships. And to that extent, I think it's a big step back in historical terms, the idea that we have these casual working arrangements. I mean, we're sitting here in a studio, which is very close to the river, so thinking back to the casualisation of dock work, but then the steps that were taken to stop that by introducing some requirement for regular and or permanent contracts for dock workers. But it's also a step backwards in terms of our international legal obligations, because under international law, we refer to the idea that labour is not a commodity. But these practices simply allow employers to treat people as if they are commodities. I mean, just to use them as and when required, and then discard them when they're no longer necessary, with the consequences that you have referred to in terms of inability to develop or to plan their lives. So from my point of view, I would see these arrangements as really being an irresponsible use of human resources, if we've got to use that term, by managers, and using labour or workers as a commodity in the process of production or in the process of servicing their business. So what we need, I think, is just like when we had this problem in the docks and elsewhere, we introduced international standards which were designed to eradicate it. We need to do something similar in the case of 0 hours and other abusive forms of contractual arrangements which are going on at the moment. But coming back specifically to your question about the bill, what the government's bill does is to respond to a demand which most recently, I think, has been expressed by ASDAW, the Shop Workers Union. And the basic idea is that people might start off on a 0 hours contract, but after a period of time, they have a right to be offered by the employer what is referred to as a guaranteed hours contract. Now, we can speak about some of the issues relating to the substance of the bill, but in principle, I think it's a good start to move towards a position whereby at some stage, every worker will be entitled to a guaranteed hours contract. It's not to say that the provisions are perfect or that there is no scope for improvement or scepticism about what's there, but we can come on to that later.
Anything to add to that, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd broadly agree with what Keith has said there. I'm delighted that the Labour government have done something to legislate in this area. We know from the UNS study that there are over a million people that are employed on these sorts of contracts. And from a recent TUC study, it was said that 84% of people employed on these sorts of contracts actually want regular hours and are suffering financially as a result of not having something. So to see some legislation in this area is a very positive step. I think we appreciate it's a very difficult area to legislate in. There are a myriad of different sectors with different circumstances, and that's obviously been a difficult task to get a sort of a legislative framework that you can apply across. That is borne through by the complexity of these provisions that, that I'm sure we'll spend some time talking about today, but even considering them as a lawyer is very difficult. And so I imagine employers, employees, unions are going to have great challenges in being able to understand and effectively implement them in workplaces. What's slightly frustrating about the provisions is the fact that so much of it is reserved for secondary legislation. And I think that has exacerbated some of the uncertainty as to exactly how they work. And it makes it very difficult to sort of apply them to a hypothetical examples to see how effective they would be. So, I mean, as Keith said, the sort of basic premise is there is an offer of guaranteed hours if you work a set number of hours over a reference period. But we don't know yet what that minimum number of hours will be. We don't know how long that reference period would be. We think it's going to be 12 weeks, but we don't know that. They talk about the hours having to be regularly worked, but we don't actually understand what they mean by what regularly means. So there's much detail that still remains to be added. And I think that's going to be all important when we see the subsequent regulations. So yes, a positive step, but I don't feel in a position to say today that they're going to be really effective in addressing this area.
So I was thinking about zero-hour contracts and the sort of adjacent contracts that are very similar to them. So how much of the legislation do we think relies on contracts being referred to as zero-hour contracts? For instance, I've got friends whose HR departments insist until they're blue in the face that they don't offer zero-hour contracts, instead calling them casual contracts. Yeah, effectively, they're the same thing. There's no guarantee of hours. So might employers just rebrand their zero-hour contracts to evade the new legislation?
I think there's different tactics that employers may use to evade the legislation. I haven't thought about it so much in terms of rebranding them. I mean, the first things first is that once you work your guaranteed hours over a reference period, the employer is then obliged to make you an offer that's reflected on the hours you have worked. But one obvious concern is an employer putting pressure on employees not to accept those hours. And I think safeguards need to be built in there to make it very clear that workers should have the right to take advice from trade unions or other third parties about the nature of the offer that they're being made. We know that they're not yet applying to agency workers, and a significant amount of vulnerable workers who need protection from this framework are agency workers. There is a consultation going on where we hope it will be extended to agency workers. I think it's of paramount importance that that is done. And yet there's these kind of ideas about the employer manipulating contractual hours so that the work will only be allocated over a set period that will always fall short of when the guaranteed offer needs to be made. The concern around that will very much depend on what level of hours is set whereby the right to have this guaranteed offer is engaged.
Yeah, interesting. There's potential for a lot of loopholes there, isn't there? Keith, what do you think about that? You know, not just contracts that are referred to as 0 hours, but all the adjacent ones. Does this cover all of them, or is it just ones referred to as 0 hours?
I wouldn't be too hung up on the definitions. It will really depend on the nature of the contract and the extent of which it would fall within the scope of the legislation as it's been set out. So the employer might try to call it something else, but if in reality it falls within the framework of the bill, then the employer won't be caught by the obligations under the bill. But I'd just like to reinforce a point, I think, that Neil made about the offers of guaranteed hours contracts which an employer might make. I think the critical weakness here, and I don't see any way to avoid this, is the fact that you've got a right to receive an offer, but you also have a right to refuse it. And the problem here, the people I speak to, is that this will simply be an interface of coercion, whereby the employer doesn't have to say expressly that we don't want you to accept this offer, but the employer can make it quite clear what the expectation is, that the arrangements will continue as they have done over the time of the reference period. And I agree, there should be some kind of pause between receiving the offer and then rejecting it. There should be an opportunity to take advice from trade unions. There should be a right for the trade union to accompany the worker to meetings with the employer where this issue will be discussed. But at the end of the day, I think that will apply in a very small number of cases, partly because of the fact that few workers in the sector will be unionised. So while in practice it would be a good idea to have safeguards before people reject the right or exercise their right not to accept a guaranteed hours contract, I think it's implausible that that will take place on a regular basis. And I think the other problem which arises is what happens if the employer doesn't make an offer? And the answer is, well, you go to an employment tribunal. Well, again, that's just implausible to think that a worker in most cases in this situation is going to bring a claim to an employment tribunal. I mean, quite apart from anything else, the cost of bringing a claim before a tribunal, you know, for many cases, will be quite disproportionate and unaffordable. So in a sense, if we're going to have this model, then we need to have some better answers to these problems. How do we ensure that employers make the offer? And how do we ensure that having made the offer, the worker is not coerced into accepting it? And these seem to me to be two core weaknesses in the bill.
Okay, so I know we want to touch on fire and rehire. So a big issue a couple of years ago, for anyone who missed it, was the shock when P&O Ferries, owned by DP World, unilaterally sacked 800 workers, physically throwing them off the ships they were working on and binned their personal belongings. They broke the law and saw any fines they had to take simply as a cost of doing business. And when asked by a government committee about this, the P&O Ferries chief executive shamelessly said they'd do it again. Now, we know that UK labour law is so impoverished as to allow this kind of flagrant abuse of workers and their trade unions. But what will the Employment Rights Bill do to close the loophole on fire and rehire and to protect workers?
So I suppose as a starting point, would it have stopped P&O? Well, the thing about P&O is that they ignored all the existing laws. So they weren't abiding to the existing framework as it was then. The new employment bill doesn't effectively deal with remedies. There's consultation out at the moment about how we can enforce this new legislative framework around fire and rehire, with a consultation on doubling the existing protective award or having an uncapped protective award and also introducing the right of interim relief. Those sort of sanctions, particularly around getting a right to interim relief, that might have stopped P&O, because then you can get into court and you can either prevent them from dismissing unlawfully or at least get a hearing where they have dismissed unlawfully with a view to getting those employees re-engaged in a very short period. In terms of what the bill does do, there is a provision within the bill now that will make a dismissal automatically unfair where an employee refuses to vary their contract, or in circumstances where there is a dismissal with a view to re-engaging that same employee on less favourable terms, or indeed re-engaging another employee on less favourable terms who effectively does the same job. So that is specifically addressing P&O, where it was bringing in a new workforce, as you say. So that measure is there to introduce it. Whether it would stop P&O in terms of it being a lawful dismissal or not would very much depend upon whether they could fall within this exemption. There is an exemption from a dismissal being automatically unfair if the company is said to be operating in significant financial distress. Whether P&O would have met that test, I don't know enough about the financial implications that were in place there, but I'm doubtful they would. Even had they done so, they certainly wouldn't have met the twin obligation there now, where the employer, before they dismiss, has to consider all viable options. But, you know, P&O would have been an unfair dismissal under the old framework. It definitely would be under the new framework. The question really is having these effective enforcement mechanisms, because that's what will really stop that happening again.
Yeah. Keith?
I think P&O is important, obviously. I mean, it is one of the great cause celebres of British labour law over the last 50 years. But it's not the only example of fire and rehire. And also, you know, fire and rehire is not a modern problem. It's one with fairly deep roots. So, I mean, so far as I can tell, I mean, certainly in modern times, it goes back to the Osborne budget in 2010. The Tories were a coalition was elected, and basically these savage cuts that were imposed on the public sector. And if you go back to 2010, 2011, you will see that local authorities were engaging in this practice. So other public bodies were engaging in this practice, dismissing and rehiring thousands of workers, fire authorities, thousands of workers, and then rehiring them on new terms and going through the motions in terms of consultation, people, not much option but to accept what's being placed in front of them. But there are other examples involving other big British-based companies doing very much the same, people walking away. Some people, I mean, so some quite sad stories about people just digging in and refusing, as a matter of principle, to accept what is a unilateral variation of the terms of their contract. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about employers seeking to impose unilaterally a change to a contract of employment without the consent of the employee. What Starmer said last year at the GMB conference was something to the effect that we will ban fire and rehire. It is as simple as that. It just needs to be done, right? So that was what he said, presumably to great applause, at the GMB. Question for Starmer is, does the bill actually do that? And you could say that what the bill does, in the sense it addresses the question of fire and rehire, in some circumstances it makes it unfair to dismiss someone because they refuse to accept a unilateral variation to their contract. But it also goes on to make clear that there is a huge exception which will allow fire and rehire to be a fair dismissal. And that what the bill does, in effect, is to provide a roadmap to employers to enable them to engage in fire and rehire in a fairly safe way. Because what it says is that, okay, it will be an unfair dismissal unless you can show that there is some economic justification. And the economic justification, in my view, is quite weak. It talks about the employer needing to mitigate the effect of any financial difficulties which are likely to affect their ability to carry on the activities constituting the business. So if you can show that, show you act reasonably, show that you consult with the employee, show that you've consulted with the unions, the recognised union, which most employers will do, then it will be a fair dismissal. And that, I think, is a problem. So in principle, it is unfair, but there is this huge exception, which allows a fire and rehire situation to be a fair dismissal. And that, I think, is the problem. This is not ending fire and rehire. This is facilitating fire and rehire. And I think the bill needs to be significantly strengthened if these limitations are to be avoided.
It always strikes me in fire and rehire situations that you have company bosses potentially making poor decisions. And then when it goes belly up, the bosses aren't the ones who forfeit their pay and bonuses. It's the very people who earn the value for the company, the workers, who have to pay the price with their livelihoods to balance the books. So how can we ensure the decision makers take the hit before more economically vulnerable workers? And how do we ensure that corporate punishment is strong enough to act as a deterrent over things like fire and rehire?
I think we could ask a number of questions here, but one, we could start with this, with Barry Gardner's bill. I mean, we had before the election, a very prominent Labour Member of Parliament, Barry Gardner, promoted what was a very well-publicised bill, which actually was also introduced in the House of Lords and was passed in the House of Lords. This bill, which was designed to stop, fire and rehire. And what Barry Gardner, the essence of Barry Gardner's bill was that trade unions should be involved in the decision-making process at a much earlier stage. Because what we have at the moment is a situation in which the employer makes the decision to dismiss, is proposing to dismiss people. Employer is making that decision without having had any consultation with the union. So the consultation with the union and then under the bill with individual workers takes place after that decision has been made. And at that stage, it's very, very difficult to change the company's mind. At that stage, you're just going through the motions of facilitating a process that will lead inexorably to dismissal. So Barry's bill was designed to ensure that there was trade union involvement in the decisions affecting the well-being of the company before that decision to dismiss was taken or before proposals were formulated to dismiss. And the idea was to get unions involved in consultation and negotiation at a much earlier stage in order to mitigate the chances that fire and rehire would be necessary. So you'd have some consensual approach to the management of the economic problems of the company. The obligation to do that arose from a European directive, which was then transposed very poorly in this country in the information and consultation regulations of 2004. So the first thing was to get better procedures. And the second thing is to say, well, okay, there will be circumstances where inevitably there will be dismissals, but the purpose of the bill was to ensure that nobody walked away empty-handed. So if somebody stood on their rights, stood on their contractual rights, they would be entitled to some form of compensation at the end of the process. The hope was that by stretching out the involvement of the unions at an earlier stage in the process, it would be possible to resolve the problems in a negotiated and amicable way. But if there were still victims, these victims would be compensated for the loss of their contractual rights. Nobody would go away empty-handed. Now, under these procedures in the bill, there is no provision for additional consultation before the employer makes a decision. And there is no guarantee that workers who are dismissed for refusing to accept a change to their contractual terms will have any compensation at all for the loss of their jobs and the loss of the contracts on which they have rightly insisted. So there is, I think there's a job of work still to be done on the bill. There are a number of changes. I think Thompson's have made some recommendations. The Institute, we've made recommendations as to how the bill could be improved. But apart from learning from Barry's bill, there are lessons to be learned from other countries as well, which I think it would be necessary to learn, or necessary to inquire about, or to be curious about, if we are genuinely interested in stopping this practice.
I think we'll come on to those international examples shortly. Neil, was there anything that you wanted to add to that?
I think it's disappointing that the bill hasn't made more comprehensive changes to the duty to collectively consult and the provisions under Section 188. It's obviously welcome that they have removed the point about the provisions only being engaged where there are 20 or more dismissals at one establishment. And as we know, that particular caveat will go. So it's proposals to dismiss 20 or more is redundant across the organisation as a whole. And that's really welcome. But that is the only change within the bill to the collective consultation obligations. The consultation response has asked for other suggestions as to how it could be strengthened, and it is right that Thompson's and the Institute have put forward proposals around that, and that would be really important, and the Barry Gardner bill was very effective in what it did in that regard, and that is missing from this bill. And it's also right, I think, to say that talking about this new right of fire and rehire, if the employer does navigate through this loophole, which I think we're agreed on is wider than we'd want it to be at the moment, then there is no right for compensation for that employee. So they still can't stand and sue on their contractual promise that they had originally made with the employer. And I suppose it's a broader point, but I think we need to move away from the fact of thinking that it's particularly radical to ban fire and rehire. A lot of what I'm reading that is being promoted by employment lawyers at the moment is this bill is wholly radical, it's too quick and it goes too far. But I don't think that's right. I mean, this is a long time coming. We've had 30, 40 years now of inadequate protection for working people and this constant unequal bargaining power between employees and employers. This is just a modest step in the other direction. And yes, it may appear radical in the sort of narrow context of what's happened before, but it isn't particularly radical, and I think we need to look at it in a wider sphere.
Yeah, that's right. And when you consider how far the scales have been unbalanced in the last 40 years, it is just a step in that direction, isn't it? Yeah. Going back to your point there, Keith, I've got a question here about historic and international examples and how the UK has dealt with fire and rehire in the past, either legally or industrially. And also, are there international examples that deal with fire and rehire well that we should be aiming towards? And I suppose just tagged on to that, is there a role for international law in this as well?
The question that I sometimes ask is why, for example, you take a country like Australia, people tell me that it's unknown in Australia, or certainly doesn't have the profile there that it has here. The colleague of mine in Australia, Marlon Pittard at Monash University, and I, we wrote a paper on this published in the Industrial Law Journal, he says shamelessly. But basically, we asked the question, why is it? What are the disincentives in the Australian system to operating these practices? I mean, it's a system based on the common law, very, very like ours in many respects. But I think the answer is that it's quite clear that on the one hand, there is no incentive, no rewards for employers who engage in this practice because there are much higher levels of regulation. So, for example, they have sectoral regulation. So we would refer to sectoral collective bargaining. These are terms and conditions set in different industries by a public body, which imposes awards which cover all the workers in a particular sector of the economy, for example, seafarers. So if a company were to dismiss all of its seafarers, say a shipping company, all of its employees, the replacement workers would have to be paid by law exactly the same amount, the same wage, as the people who had been dismissed, because you've got this regulatory standard for the sector. And this is why, I mean, we keep on going on about sectoral collective bargaining, why it is so important. It is important because it helps to address so many of the problems that we have in our current labour law system. But that'd be one way in Australia. One is to say, well, we need to take regulation seriously. We need to embrace it as a good thing. And that would be one example. Secondly, they have a much tighter unfair dismissal law. So you don't have in Australia the power of the employer to dismiss someone for some other substantial reason. You can dismiss for misconduct or capability or redundancy. But we don't have this broad power of the employer to dismiss for some other substantial reason, which would include dismissal because you won't accept a variation of the terms of the contract. And thirdly, we have in Australia, and this would have been important in the P&O case, collective agreements are legally binding, which almost uniquely in the world, in this country, collective agreements are not legally binding. They're deemed not to be legally binding contracts. Now, you find it hard in any other country in the world to find a law which says something similar. Why is it that collective agreements are not legally binding? In Australia, they are legally binding, as they are in most other countries. And that would stop P&O from doing what they did in the case of the 800 or so seafarers. And the other point, of course, comes back to something we discussed earlier, is they've got much stronger remedies. So they've got the capacity, they've got a third-party agency, which has the capacity to apply for tougher sanctions than we would be comfortable with in this country. But again, not only do we need to be comfortable with the idea that regulation is a good thing, we also need to be comfortable with the idea that strong sanctions to enforce people's rights is a good thing. And we've got to get away from this nonsense of people being able to go to tribunals, as you say, 18 months down the line for a ridiculously low sum of money, but to a body which has no effective executive power or authority to do very much that would change people's lives significantly for the better by upholding their legal rights. But we've got a long, long way to go before we can get to a situation in which we can proudly say that we have a modern labour law for a modern economy. And the problem at the moment is that we've got 21st century laws and we're still operating 19th century remedies. That's got to stop.
Did you want to add anything to that?
Well, I was listening to something recently about, you know, talking about statutory provisions that seem particularly radical at a time and are now just accepted as a norm. And a good example of that is obviously the national minimum wage when it was introduced by the last Labour government. Fierce opposition, and there's no administration would remove that now. And I think that is right, that this bill here represents a real opportunity and we shouldn't see anything as being off the table, and greater regulation will have to be part of that, but it's not something that we should be frightened of. It should be something that we should embrace. And I think it will obviously protect workers, but it will also be more effective for the wider economy anyway.
Quite right. Any brief final thoughts before our time is up?
Just one other thing we need to never, ever lose sight of is that when we're looking at this bill, we need looking at solutions and remedies. We must always be looking at ways by which we should be re-empowering trade unions to act on behalf of their members specifically, but workers generally. And one of the, I mean, we're talking about fire and rehire, we're talking about P&O. One of the big lessons to come from that, as the ILO Freedom of Association Committee pointed out, is the need to restore the right to take sympathy action so that other groups of workers could come to the aid of the seafarers at P&O ferries to get them back into their employment.
I think, sadly, we've come to the end of our time again. Thanks to our expert speakers, Professor Keith Ewing and Neil Todd, for sharing their knowledge and experience with us. We really appreciate you taking your time out of your very busy schedules to be part of this and help inform our listeners. If you, the listeners, would like to be notified of future episodes, please consider subscribing to the podcast. If you'd like to support the work of IER, you can donate to us, subscribe to our labour law publications, or attend our educational events. If you'd simply like to learn more, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at ier.org.uk. Thanks again to Thompson Solicitors for their kind support for this podcast, and thanks to you, the listeners, for being part of our new podcast and being part of the debate.
This podcast is sponsored by Thompson Solicitors, and it's produced for the Institute of Employment Rights by Creative Kin. To find out more, visit creativekin.co.uk/IER.